Welcome back to the Bastian Ann Podcast's Niche Explorer series, where each week I'll be welcoming a new guest to talk about their own personal corner of the tabletop gaming world. I'm Chris McDowell, and today I'm joined by an RPG writer who has explored worlds from the frozen wilderness of prehistory through to the esoteric underworlds of today and the impossible in between. She is the Stygian librarian, the Indian gardener, the dolorous stroker, and the blogging cave girl. Welcome, Emmy Allen.
Hi. Yeah. I'm immediately unsure whether or not I should point out the innuendo in dolorous stroker or not.
You know what? I wrote it and I thought, because it just followed on naturally from Stygian librarian and Indian gardener, and then I thought, should I leave that there or should I take it out? So I am happy to remove it if you want.
Let's keep the smut in.
Yeah, I figured you'd be okay with it. But it was not deliberate, I can assure you. Purely innocent intentions here.
Of course.
So those people who can't decode that that sprawling introduction, where might people know you from?
So most of the design work I've done has been in the sort of retro old school space. So I've had a couple of projects which are basically taking your standard old school model and going, well, how would this work if it was in a modern day crime setting, or how would this work if it was prehistoric? And then at the same time, I've got a couple of modules which are basically almost procedurally generated, almost roguelike style, rolling up locations as you go to get like just randomly created like extraplanar adventures that will be different every time you try and run them. But then the big one that I think we're talking about today is the Dolorous Stroke, which is wildly different to all of the other stuff. And it's basically it's a tabletop war game, so it's, you know, miniatures and dice and model terrain and all of that stuff. And it's very loose and freeform and doing everything it can to not be competitive, and much more about like creating a scenario and telling an interesting story with like your models and your mechanics, rather than making it, you know, about winning.
And that's kind of in many ways, that's sort of the promise of war games that many people are sold, is the idea that you're going to create these stories and have these characters. And it's got some really interesting parallels to sort of that in RPGs as well. There's some people that feel that that's underserved in role-playing games, but I think in war games, it's certainly a very small corner of the hobby, it seems. I mean, part of that is just by the nature of Games Workshop having such a huge monopoly. But what's, in terms of narrative war games, as we might call them, what's your sort of history with those games?
So I started out with Warhammer Fantasy back in 5th edition, and then moved on to, like, I played like more time when it came out. I started doing Inquisitor when it came out, and then like those were games I dabbled in, but the other big one I played was the Lord of the Rings game that they made to like complement the films, which was, it was really different to all the other stuff that Games Workshop did. Like, it messed with the turn sequence and it went, well, we're going to do scenarios, and no, the scenario is not balanced, like one side won, so we're going to make it reflect that. And it was very, it was very story-driven compared to a lot of their other stuff. So that was a big influence on me. And then, like, outside of Games Workshop, like, I've played around with Malifaux, where, like, I love the setting, I love the models, the game makes my brain hurt. Like, it's so, so many moving parts clicking together to make weird stuff happen. And then, like, I've done, like, absolutely fuck tons of homebrew stuff that I've gone, well, I'll just put this together, run it as like a scenario for a couple of friends and move on. And it's like, you know, it's a one-shot thing rather than a like a finished product, but just being able to go to the club and sit down and go, well, I've got these rules, let's see how they work, has been really really instructive.
Yeah, and a lot of the people that are going to be listening to this podcast, I guess, are going to be RPG people primarily. But it's interesting seeing that the parallel is so strong with the kind of the sort of the community, whatever you want to call it online, that sort of the sort of DIY role-playing game OSR type mess, where there was so much focus on make the thing that you want to use, like every single person having their own little homebrew twist on D&D or something completely new. And I think that side of things in the wargaming hobby is much more hidden. It may be just because I'm much more exposed to role-playing games, but I didn't really realize it was happening on the scale that it is. And I still felt like most people were still just playing still playing Games Workshop stuff, which is exactly what we all complain about when we say that everyone just plays D&D and nobody knows about all these other games. So it's easy to see how people fall into that trap of thinking that there's only one game in town.
Yeah. So I think a problem which wargaming has, which is kind of parallel to the D&D is everything problem in RPGs, is that even a lot of the like interesting indie games still take the basic assumptions that comes with Warhammer, that you're going to be playing, you know, a balanced scenario where you pick your things with a points list and you're trying to win. And like it always comes with this assumption that, well, you're going to make what you think is the right tactical move, not the move that's, you know, in character or interesting or emotionally dramatic or whatever. And I find that, like, even a lot of the little indie games that I've played, like Drop Fleet Armada or something, it's all very, it's competitive. Like, it's a game that you play to win. And I think there's a lot of potential that gets really only seen in like historical wargaming and the very kind of artsy Dark Age of Sigmar and Quizzamonger style games that gets massively underserved, to be honest.
The thing that sold me on this idea, and I'm not just saying this because you're here now, it was two things really. You wrote a blog post about Inquisitor, and my memory of Inquisitor, I think I'm slightly older than you, so my memory is slightly different, because Inquisitor sort of came out when you were like, would you say this was like when you were like peak into the hobby, I guess, when you were growing up?
Oh, no. I was still getting into it at that point. I was like 12 at the time.
But you were still like, you weren't the cynical, teenager. You're on the rise. So, you know, I can see how that coming out at an early stage would be seen differently. Because when it came out, I was it was towards the sort of tail end of my engagement with the hobby as I was growing up. And I just remember still to this day, the fact that they made it, is it 54 millimeter scale? I think that was both, I massively respect that decision, because it must have been a very hard decision to push through at Games Workshop HQ. I can't imagine that conversation, how it went. But also to me, it just completely made it way too daunting for me, because even conversions with like 28 mil bits that I had lying around was daunting for me back then. But the idea of sort of not only just buying this huge 54 mil figure, but then also having to like convert it with bits that I don't have. So to be honest, I completely slept on Inquisitor until I think you wrote the blog post a few years ago now. And I sort of thought, oh yeah, I vaguely remember seeing this in White Dwarf and thinking, to be honest, at the time thinking it was a stupid idea and not really understanding it, which I imagine lots of people had the same experience. Then I read through it, and the bit that really leapt out to me was your point about how you would just, that there's sort of no guidance for like balance for characters. It's sort of like, if you want to make a tech priest, then, you know, give them the scores that sound right for a tech priest. And I just loved that philosophy and thinking about where that could go. So in the post, you spoke about doing that with role-playing game characters, but even doing it with sort of armies, you know, your entire side of the battle could be done that way. And it really woke me up to that idea, something I hadn't really considered before, because I was kind of stuck in this Games Workshop upbringing, if you like.
Well, I mean, it's the same in D&D is, well, you have these really strict rules for character journey. You get this much money and your stats need to be about this, and you start out at level one. No, you can't have all the spells you want. And it's such a straitjacket to creativity. Is like, I've done a lot of vampire LARPs, And I massively prefer NPCing, just because, like, when you play as a player character, you have to obey the rules in character gen, and you have this many points to spend. But as an NPC, you go, well, what would it make sense for this character to have? And you don't have to care about all that fucking spreadsheet stuff, you know? And I think that applies to most, I don't know what the term is, like, analog gaming.
Yeah, yeah.
Is everything's very tightly defined when it doesn't need to be.
Even when you're like GMing the game, I remember when I was sort of playing third edition. And again, this was my early days of role-playing games, really. So
yeah.
I was just going off what was in the book and sort of very few articles that were available online for me at the time. And just the idea that looking through the monster manual and seeing like a purple worm and thinking, oh, this looks cool, but oh, I can't really use that until they get to level 12 or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I understand why that sort of structure is appealing to some people, but it's like you say, it's if you're just playing in a more casual, friendly, and I don't mean casual in a derogative term there, a sort of non-competitive style, more focused on just telling a good story, you can throw that purple worm in with level one characters. And obviously, if they try and fight it, they're going to die, but you can still have it there. I mean, certain systems make it more difficult than others, I won't lie. But that was a really interesting take to see on your blog about Inquisitor.
I think because Inquisitor came out at the same time the Lord of the Rings game did, and the Lord of the Rings, like, you could see there were these two different instincts they had going, where everything had a points value. And they had rules, okay, if you want to take your points values and make, you know, a competitive army, this is how you would do that. But, like, the bulk of the rule book was, you know, this is how you fight Amonhen, this is how you fight Helm's Deep, this is how you fight the dwarves losing Moria. And it was all scenario-based. It was all, this is this situation and how you would model this situation and what you're trying to do. And those were wildly unbalanced scenarios, but it didn't have that expectation. And you can see, like, really, really strongly in Lord of the Rings game that they are almost, like, arguing with themselves about what direction they want the game to go in, and they really can't, they haven't made a firm decision about whether it's a narrative game or a competitive game. And it's fascinating to look at in retrospect.
Again, that was another system that I did kind of sleep on. I think that came in just after I was sort of clocking off from the hobby, really, around that time. I was far too cool for that sort of thing around there. Yeah, it's perhaps interesting because I've not really got much interest at all in sort of real world military history, to be honest. And that side of wargaming never really appealed to me. But from what little I've seen, it's much more common over there on that side of things to have these. Yeah, because if you're running. I mean, I'm going to struggle to even name a real battle now, but if you're running like Agincourt or whatever, presumably there is like those forces weren't balanced at the time, which is why one side won.
Can I be a history nerd?
Oh, go on. Was Agincourt the pinnacle of balanced battles?
No, it's the other way around. Like, the English were vastly outnumbered and technically vastly outgunned. It's just the French fucked it up so badly that, like, it wasn't fair, but the side you would expect to lose didn't.
But that's interesting because it kind of fits into this, again, I keep trying to draw parallels to role-playing games, because you kind of, the parallel between army building and character building as the kind of the skill that happens before the game. In something like 40K, certainly from my memory, you could build an incredibly good list or an incredibly bad list, and then when you deploy, the battle could almost be decided already.
Yeah, just based on, well, you don't have an answer to this unit, it's going to curb stomp everything, good luck.
Yeah, so it doesn't have that potential for that kind of Agincourt situation where the weaker side can win if the stronger side plays really badly. I mean, it could still happen, but it's minimizing that. So
mostly doesn't.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that kind of, I'm gonna twist that around to say that kind of proves my point. Where if you want to have these narrative scenarios where you've got unbalanced forces, I think with the right system, you can still have the potential for It's leaning into the player skill rather than the character skill, if you like, or the army power, I suppose.
I mean, there's so many cases where, if you look at a historical battle, if somebody with the very modern, very competitive wargame attitude tried to refight it, you wouldn't get the results that happened historically because, like, people don't have the flaws and prejudices of those generals. Like, you don't have, for example, if you look at World War II, I have a little army of Pacific Japanese troops for, I think it's not Bolt Action, it's the other one.
Flames of War?
That's the one. But if you look at it, like, they've needed to build a rule in to represent the whole Banzai Charge thing, where the Japanese often wouldn't make a tactically sensible retreat, because players won't do that otherwise, because it's not in the zeitgeist to do the characterful thing.
And it's so on the you're the second episode I'm recording here. I'm showing behind the curtain because I don't think you're actually going to be the second episode released. But in a previously released episode, I've spoken to Joseph McCulloch, who wrote Frostgrave and various other games, and we were talking about morale in role playing in war games, skirmish games in particular. And we kind of were saying that if it's just a one off battle, then there's no consequences. Similar to if you're just running a one shot role playing game, you're really disincentivized from, like, protecting your character. Because you're thinking, well, once this game's over, I'm going to go back to the convention. I'm never going to touch this character sheet again. But that, the sort of the campaign focus that he runs for his game means that he felt like he didn't need to have a morale system, because if things are going badly and you know that you don't want more of your troops to die than you need to,
because you've invested resources in the load of the campaign.
And you want them to live for the next battle. And ideally, if this is like the 10th time you've fought with these two little archers that you've kept alive, and there's a big monster heading towards them, you're going to want to protect them because you've become a little bit attached to those models.
Like, I know I've played Mordheim, and I've had a lot of, like, rotating cast where I've gone, well, you know, have some dudes with spears because you need dudes with spears. And there'll be like, two of my little dudes have survived since game one. And you get properly gutted when they die, because you get invested. And I think that's the real strength of something like Necromunda or that style of game, which I think Frostgrave is building into, is it makes you personalize each of the individual characters, and then the longer that you play with them, the more they become unique to your thing, because they, you know, their stats change and they get new equipment and so on, and they become something you can't replace. It's very sneaky.
Even without the mechanical, so I'm not going to turn this into the Frostgrave podcast, but, like, one of the criticisms that I often see of Frostgrave is that your sort of your leader, your wizard, will level up as you go on, but your sort of grunts at the bottom in your warband don't advance; they don't improve their stats. But I still feel like if I've, like you say, if I've kept this one little warhound alive for six battles. And I've given them a name, and I think about all the people that they've bitten to death. I'm still going to want to protect them, but the flip of that is how do you do the opposite of that? Where if you want to have that, you know, Japanese troops in the Pacific situation, where it's almost the opposite of that self-preservation thing for your troops, how would you? Is there a way of getting you to feel that kind of? Getting the player to feel in that moment rather than mechanically enforcing it, if that makes sense.
I mean, I think one of the big tricks that I used with the Order of Stroke was to go, well, you can do what you like with your characters. Just because they die in the scenario doesn't mean they're going away. You know, you can take this as an opportunity to go, well, you know, now they've, you know, lost some fingers, or, you know, now they've been knocked on the head one time too many and have lost all sense of self-preservation or whatever. But you're not being held back by mechanics telling you what you need to do with your characters. So you can go, yeah, I'm going to do this incredibly risky, incredibly stupid thing, and not feel threatened, not feel like you are losing something when that happens, because everything's under your control.
it's going to be better for the story, I suppose, as well, which is the, you know, throughout the book of the Dolorous Stroke, it's sort of repeated over and over again that, you know, that the focus is on making the story rather than creating a competitive environment.
Like, it's one of those things where I felt I really needed to beat the reader around the head with it, because it's such a different approach. But for a game like that to work, fundamentally, you kind of can't solve it with mechanics. You need to solve it with explaining what the social contract of the game is and what the expectations for the game is and what your creative agendas going in are. And if you can get that down, then honestly, most players will make that happen regardless of your mechanics. Like, I think a lot of the time, there are a lot of games where I kind of feel like the mechanics don't support the play style that well, but because they communicate like what the game is about so well, because they're really hitting you over the head with, this is what the game is about, this is what you do, this is your approach to it, you will still get that experience out of it. Like Vampire the Masquerade, for example, it's really good at communicating, this is the tone we're going for, this is, you know, it's about angst and melodrama and, you know, deep character interactions and politics and all of that stuff. And then the mechanics are mostly intricacies of how you shoot people, but also nobody uses those mechanics because the game is so good at communicating, you know, this is a character-driven, emotionally-driven story that you're telling.
And that sort of ties into your early D&D. You know, there's been lots of discussion around D&D's combat mechanics and whether that means that it's a game about combat or not. We won't go into that 100% today. But the one thing that I think is worth bearing in mind is, obviously, if you've not read those early editions of D&D, it's easy to miss all those mechanics that are in there that support the kind of dungeon crawling style of play, and sort of the fact that you've got reaction rolls and you've got rules for you know, listening at doors. So it's I wouldn't say that it does an especially good job of telling you the type of game that it is, because obviously we wouldn't be here having arguments 40 years later if that was the case. But I think there's a lot of parallels there where it's not enough to just write a game that has the right mechanics. It's about how you tell people how to actually use those mechanics as well.
I mean, this is something which I'm really doing with my current project, where, like, it's this little indie, very almost kind of personal thing about, like, queer women down a dungeon having horrible things happen to them. And, like, mechanics take up 5 pages at the front of the book, and the rest of it is, this is how, like, I expect the game is going to be played, this is, like, what we're going for tonally, this is how you would handle all of these things. And the bulk of the book is about setting up the social contracts and the expectations for the game, rather than more detailed mechanics for that stuff. Like, if you tell players that, you know, this is a game where you would expect your characters to fall in love and this is the kind of story you could expect to tell from that, you don't need mechanics for that.
Yeah.
As long as you're priming them.
It's tricky, isn't it? Because it's one thing to get the person running the game to get on board with it, because they're probably going to be the one sat reading the book. But how do you make sure that the players are on board with that as well?
I honestly don't have an answer to that. Honestly, I kind of design based on exactly what I would need.
Yes, yeah.
To get the experience from a game. And I'm somebody that reads rule books. Like, I find it very difficult to go, okay, well, how could I write a game for a player that doesn't read books? It's like, you can only do so much with that. And I think if the GM has a very strong vision for the game, which you can, like, hopefully the GM's read the book, then the GM can communicate that to the players. But, like, ideally, you would want players to actually have, you know, if not read the book, then at least kind of skimmed the key bits and gone, okay, this is what the game's about, this is what I would expect from it. Yeah. Like, you can do a lot with kind of signposting what the game is about with the blurb and the cover and the aesthetic stuff, so that even if they don't read the, like, the big chunks of text, they can still go, well, I get what the feel of this is. And I think that's something which 40K does very well, actually, is even if you don't read the mechanics, if you look at some of the old, like, 3rd edition, 4th edition 40K books, you can open them up and go, holy shit, there's all this graphic design and art happening at me, and I get this setting now.
Yeah.
You know, it communicates feel really well.
Definitely. It's the 40K setting is a real, it's simultaneously both like a big inspiration to me in how it's presented, but mm-hmm. also like there's bits of it that I, if it were me, I would do differently. That's not to say it's the right way.
Like please stop with the space marines. We have enough space marines. Something else. Well, anything
you know
else.
What? I almost think it would be better if they either said, look, this is now a game about space marines and all of the different chapters of space, and you know, lean into it and make it make sense. I'm not saying that's what I want, but I think you would end up with a more coherent product if they just either did that or said, no, this is a game where you can play as Eldar, for instance, and not have to use 20-year-old miniatures. But
I mean, you say that, the Eldar miniatures are so much fucking better than some of the stuff they're making at the moment. Like,
yeah. Should we have like a 5-minute rant on miniatures?
Yeah, I can do that.
We'll limit ourselves. I know this isn't this is the intermission in the middle of the podcast where we can just rant.
Yeah. So, like, I started around 5th edition Warhammer, and a big thing they were doing then was multi-part flexible kits.
Yeah.
Where there wasn't like a predetermined this is how you assemble it, just gave you a pile of torso, a pile of heads, and you knocked yourself out with it. And I really wish they'd go back to that approach. I've been making a lot of the new Sisters of Battle, for example.
Hmm.
And they're beautiful models, but they're such a pain to convert because like each arm fits onto a specific shoulder.
Yeah.
And if you want to put different arms on different bodies, you need to green stuff it. And I just miss when everything was cross-compatible.
I mean, maybe it's just because I've set an incredibly low standard for myself, but I've been just kit-bashing loads of random bits together. And sometimes, like, the shoulder looks a bit weird and it doesn't quite work. And, like, the bit where the wrist connects to the arm is clearly, like, wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's because, the multi-part kits, I remember... I'm not going to try and sound like I'm saying about the old days, but like back in the old days, everything was sort of one pose except for, weirdly, skeletons. Like the Skeleton Warriors set was like the one that was like a multi-part, you could pose them any way you want. So I remember buying like a pack of skeletons just for fun, even though I didn't have an undead army.
Yeah.
It was, and just being able to like position them was like the biggest novelty in the world.
Mm-hmm.
I think, I don't know, if you started with 5th edition Warhammer, you're going to have to remind me based on what was in the starter set.
5th edition was Lizard Men and Bretonians.
Ah, yes. So that was like the edition. I remember that edition coming out, and I remember thinking, that was around the time that, like you say, all the multi-part kits came out. So it's weird because when I'd sort of dipped back into it this year, I bought the Skitarii set and the Gene Stealer Neophytes and just kit-bashed them all together. And they kind of fit, but I think I was spoiled a little bit because I think those are some of the more flexible kits.
Mm.
But then what did I buy? I went onto bitsbox.co.uk, which is an incredibly dangerous site to go to.
Oh yeah, I've given them so much money.
It's awful. Like I originally thought I'll save loads of money because I'm just going to buy like this one head instead of having to buy a whole caudal box. And then no, I've spent more than but it's great. And going through there, like the amount of times I'll buy like a torso and some legs, and then when they arrive, it'll be like, oh well, no, this isn't the right torso for these legs, so they really don't quite fit. So it's kind of a weird double edged sword at the minute, where there's so many nice little bits in those sets, but it is also slightly stifling to try and you've got to use these arms with this torso and so on.
I mean, it could be so much worse. Yeah. Like I don't know, are you familiar with the whole Malifaux thing?
I very loosely, like I remember reading the rule book and having a similar experience to you where I was like, this looks really fancy, but I think it's a bit fancy for me mechanically.
So the models are like, they're lovely models, but at the same time, there's one of the guys comes with a separate beard, and it's a tiny wispy goatee, but it's a separate component that you glue on individually. And like there are models with individual toes that you glue on. And it's just fucking, how do you expect me to assemble these? You have no expectation that anybody's going to be able to convert this stuff. because you've got the, what's the phrase? It's like one elbow part of a pouch and some boot is one component.
Right.
Until you've assembled everything, it's this incomprehensible mess of parts. And like, I love the models, but they're such a nightmare to do anything with.
Yeah, it's interesting because, if you are interested in multi-part bits and the Frostgrave kits, I don't know if you've seen it
before. Oh, I've got some, they're beautiful.
Yeah, they arrived yesterday, mine did. They arrived as I was talking to Joseph McCullough, which was a weird coincidence. They seem to be, I was incredibly happy when I opened up the box and there were no instructions in the box. It was literally just like some sprues.
Work it out. It'll all fit.
It was like, that's a body. That's a head. Yeah. There's a few little bits where I'm like, is this a ponytail or I'm not entirely sure, but I'm just going to make it work. And it kind of fits into that, something that I think was really interesting. Something that I think was really useful from a game design perspective was when I was really young, I inherited a HeroQuest board game that was missing like the scenario book and like a few key pieces. Me and a friend had to like make up rules to fill the gaps, basically. I sort of feel like in the same way that everyone that wants to have a go at game design should get like an incomplete rule set and see if they can fill the gaps in it just as a little exercise. I sort of feel like if a miniature set is good, it kind of shouldn't need instructions, and it sometimes maybe benefit from not having instructions. But perhaps there's a lot that I don't know about digital miniature sculpting and all the fanciness that goes into Games Workshop miniatures, so who knows?
I guess one thing which I found, actually, is a lot of the very modular designs is, if you look at any of the Perry Twins stuff they're doing with historical miniatures now, it's very similar. You've got, you know, your separate arm, your separate head, your separate torso. And you assemble them how you want. And they're kind of, I think, the inheritors of, in a lot of ways, those multi-part kits the Games Workshop used to do. But, you know, historically accurate.
Cool. Well, I'm trying not to buy any more miniatures for the time being. So I'm going to instantly wipe all those recommendations from my memory, just for my own.
Oh, I have a list that I can send you.
You can, maybe in like a month. I will wait, and you can send me the list then, because I'm being incredibly strict on my unpainted miniature situation. I've been quite good at it. I've been a lot better than I used to be, so part of the reason that I jumped back into miniatures this year, a lot of it was to do with lockdown, but then it was also I discovered that it was tapping something for me that RPGs wasn't. So for you, what do war games offer you that a role-playing game doesn't?
Honestly, to a certain extent, I think wargaming is, the game itself is secondary to the arts and crafts side of it.
Yeah.
About this time last year, actually, I ran a Dollar a Stroke campaign where I made big old terrain boards, bunch of custom terrain for it, miniatures for everybody, and ran like a little group of three or four people for a scenario each week. And from my end, at least, the fun of that was going, okay, so next week's scenario, we're going to have, you know, an ambush in a graveyard. So we're going to make some skeletons, we're going to make some graveyard terrain, and we're make, you know, a giant zombie dragon or whatever. It's almost like it's an excuse to show off the cool models that you've made.
Yeah.
And see them in action. And the rules are there to support that rather than the other way around. Like, one thing which I think Inquisitor did very well was go, the expectation is you're going to come up with an idea, and you're going to convert a model, and then you can work out what all the mechanic stuff is after that.
Yeah.
But for me, at least, wargaming is all about the visual spectacle of it. It's about making something which is, in a very kind of tactile way, just cool.
And it's the game serving the miniatures and the table rather than the other way around. Like, I think it's fair to say I wouldn't, if I was going to sit down and play, let's say Mordheim, if I was going to sit down and play Mordheim and I was using like wooden, unpainted wooden blocks and paper miniatures. I would probably still have an okay time, but I think I would rather play, you know, a theatre of the mind role-playing game. I think for me, it's like those two extremes where you either go in whole hog and you've got the terrain and the miniatures and it all looks really cool, or that's kind of theatre of the mind. And it's when you get into that middle ground that I find it, I get a bit of sort of cognitive dissonance. It's like it's like the classic sort of way to play like fifth edition D&D or whatever, where you're talking for like an hour with theatre of the mind interactions and so on, and then
you break out the grid and models, and it's like
exactly. And it's both those things in isolation are cool. Like the battle in itself, well, maybe not fifth edition, but the miniature battle in itself is fun, and like the sort of exploration social side of it is fun. But it's like having,
they don't gel.
Yeah, it's like having like a creme caramel on the side of your steak or something. Like it's not a good combination. I don't think I'd rather have one or the other. I'd rather not have them together. From this is kind of a very tricky question because I certainly don't have an answer. I'm sure you will have an incredibly insightful answer. How can RPGs learn from war games?
Honestly, I think one of the things which war games do really well is, I'm just going to put aside the we're playing 40k and we're trying to win side of things, and we're going to pretend that that all doesn't exist. And you look at like the historical stuff and Inquisitor and so on, where it goes in with this expectation that there isn't any balance, that you make what suits the, you know, the actual forces involved, and you play it out to see what will happen, and, you know, to tell an interesting story and to recreate this historical event or whatever. I think that approach is something that RPGs could really embrace. I think a lot of RPGs make the mistake of going, well, everything has to, you know, be mechanically defined in character creation, and characters need to be balanced against each other. And they don't. Just make the character. Whatever mechanically represents that character, that's what you have. And it's something you see a lot with the whole Inquisimunda thing, is the mechanics are wildly unbalanced sometimes, and always in service of the model and always in service of the concept. And I think there's a lot of room for RPGs to take things away from that. And then there's the other thing, where honestly I think some of the best like graphic design and layout and visual communication in analog games is all being done by Games Workshop. Like they're just, how they make their books is so, they are absolutely at the top of their game with that. And even if you don't really dig what they're doing mechanically, or even if you're not really into the whole, you know, Ubermen in space thing that 40k is, you can look at how they lay out their books and how they use their graphic design to communicate and go, holy shit, let's do this. Let's take this thing where they have a piece of information on a page, and all of the layout around that is there to draw attention in the right place and to use like illustration and graphic design to communicate this feeling to you. They're super good at that. Anyways, I think a lot of RPG products kind of fail at.
It's tricky because RPGs are kind of, I think perhaps by the inclusion of a GM, it can afford to be a lot looser, and by the fact that it's not strictly competitive. So I think it probably comes from that kind of the idea that they've got to write this for a tournament almost, and it's got to be so clear that, because if anything is not clear, they're going to be getting 1,000 emails about it, asking how this works. Whereas in a role-playing game, when somebody emails me and says, how does this work in Electric Bastion? I can just say, well, you know, do what feels right. But you can't quite get away with that in a war game. But it's interesting what you said about, I guess, like the miniatures first, I guess, is kind of the approach that, that I think we're sort of dancing around, where like it's very reminiscent of, especially if you look at the early days of Games Workshop, and you look at sort of the miniatures they were releasing, it was just like a random random mishmash of, like, they had the license to some Judge Dredd stuff.
Yep, they had some Doctor Who stuff. It was
all over. They had some weird aliens. They had some fantasy stuff. So then when you look at, like, Rogue Trader, the fact that you've got, like, Orangutan Jacaro, is it?
Yeah.
Things like that. I can only imagine that it just came from the idea that they had this miniature lying around. And they're like, well, I want to use this miniature, so I'm going to find a way to make this orangutan fit in my dark gothic sci-fi game. And I think with RPGs, it's different because you're kind of not restrained by what monsters you can put in your setting. So people can kind of come up with anything. But there's some weird parallels to like the early days of D&D, where it was more of a war game.
Like, a load of the early monsters were, well, you know, Dave Arneson found this stuff in a pound shop.
And I think the point I'm sort of meandering around is it's a phrase that I've used before, that, you know, the game should serve the setting rather than the other way around. And I think a lot of people sometimes, they think, I'm going to make a role-playing game, and they sit down and they start thinking about mechanics, and they start thinking about a really clever idea for a core mechanic.
Mm-hmm.
Where it's like, well, if I have 3d4 and a d8, and then you roll them and you're trying to make sets of matching numbers, then that gives a really interesting probability curve. And I was going to say, I'm not saying that's wrong, but I am. I'm going to say that's wrong and people shouldn't do it. I think instead...
Oh, yeah, I'm with you.
Yeah. it's all kind of for nothing unless you've got that inspiration for what is your game actually going to be. Because your game isn't going to be a game about rolling dice and trying to match up numbers, because
one hopes
that's like a drinking game. Like, if you just want to play a game where you're rolling dice and having fun, but your game is the way that your players engage with the game is going to be through the world and through the setting, and that's what they're going to remember. In the same way that when I think back to, you know, playing Necromunda when I was growing up, I remember the miniatures, I remember some of the really exciting scenarios, I remember all the stuff about the different houses and the different gangs. But then if you sat me down and asked me to tell you some of the rules for Necromunda now, I'd struggle with a lot of them because they've just fallen out of my head, because that's not what engaged us in it originally.
Oh yeah. Like, if you go back to, I think my favorite game that I have played is Gorkamorka. If you know it.
Yes.
The rules for Gorkamorka are fucking bad. Like, they're terrible.
It's not
a balanced game in any way. I've played at least one game where, like, I had pedal-powered vehicles for all my little goblins.
Right.
And turn one, they just shot off the other side of the board, and that was it. Game over. But the setting is communicated so well, and the tone is communicated so well, that you come away going, Gorkamorka, I know exactly what it's about. I know exactly, like, the tone it's going for. I mean, admittedly, like, I still remember the time my goblins pedaled off the edge of the board, whereas I don't remember most of the more serious 40k games I've played, so...
Yeah, exactly.
But, like, it communicates tone first, and then all of the rules and so on are in service to that, even if they're not a great, like, competitive game.
Going back to your discussion about the whole sort of Japanese Pacific War charge thing, you in Gorkamorka, I seem to remember, even when I was just a young person playing it, I remember thinking these rules are kind of janky at the time, and they were quite different. I remember thinking it was just going to be like Necromunda but with orcs, and it really was. It had some really weird mechanics in there.
Oh yeah,
and ramming another vehicle was kind of inadvisable, really. But we would do it every single time because you're playing orcs driving a truck around and your truck has a giant ram on the front of it.
And it's funny.
Yeah, like, you're not going to not ram the other truck. If you decide to not ram the other truck, then you shouldn't be playing the game.
Yeah.
to some extent. And that is perhaps the key point, is that with like historical war games, it's very different to represent all of the different factors that affected why soldiers acted a certain way in a particular theater during a particular period. But if you want to make a game where your orcs talk like football hooligans and drive big Mad Max rocket trucks around, it's much easier for me to get into that frame of mind.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something else that I think is useful for role-playing games is I think sometimes it pays to be not as subtle as you think you need to be. When you're trying to establish tone, sometimes less is more, but sometimes more is more. Mm-hmm. If you're trying to get the players on board initially.
Yeah.
That's kind of the 40K thing all round, isn't it, really? I think that's why it's provocative, is you can look at one picture.
Yeah.
And it doesn't make any sense, but you get it.
Yeah. And I mean, I think a lot of the role-playing games that have really grabbed me are the ones which do something very specific and then communicate that really well. I think that's a good example of that. I mean, Monster Hearts. Monster Hearts goes right at the beginning, this is a game about being incredibly gay at everyone, and like, if you're not playing it to do that, you're playing the game wrong. And it's just so upfront.
Definitely, yeah.
With its goals, that I think more games need to do that. I think a lot of the mistakes something like Fifth Ed makes is Fifth Ed pretends that it's a game that can handle everything, that can do all of the different stories that you want to tell with it, and it's just not. Like, it does one very specific style of game. And I mean, it does it okay. Like, if you want to play the Avengers, but it's fantasy, Fifth Ed will do a good game of that. But it's not. It's not going to give you a gritty dungeon crawl, and it's not going to give you, you know, emotional internal turmoil. It just doesn't support that stuff. But the presentation acts like it does.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people I think Warhammer Fantasy roleplay, especially in the UK, I think is quite common as either a first or second game that people check out. And I know I checked it out before I played D&D, but from the people I've heard that sort of started with D&D and then tried out Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay, it seems like a recurring theme that it just had a much more specific tone. So they knew what they were getting, and people are kind of on the same page. Like, if everybody played Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay in a sealed room, I think 10 groups could come out and they would have quite a lot in common. Which sounds like it sounds like it could be a bad thing, but I think when you're looking at like actually designing a game that does that thing well, it's good to have that focus. And like Dollar a Stroke as well. I'm not a historian, but would you classify it as a historical game?
Oh God, no, hell no! It's wildly what's the phrase? It's like romantic fantasy, and it's taking a lot of inspiration from historical literature.
Yeah,
but it's not inspired by actual history.
Yes, so we didn't have wizards for real, did we? Just to be clear.
No, right, and nobody took chivalry seriously.
No, okay. Looking through it, it very quickly puts you in that frame of mind because of the focus on this, you know, your chivalric characters. Like, you can't help but feel that you're slipping into that frame of mind. In the same way as when you read Gorkamorka, you feel like you're slipping into that. And it kind of makes me think that, like, I don't know what I have left in my life that can be served by a generic RPG system, like your kind of GURPS style. Maybe I'm being unfair, and I don't know if those games still really exist.
I mean, people still recommend Fate.
Oh, God. Sorry, I forgot. I don't know how I forgot about Fate when people always tell me to...
Have you considered playing Fate?
I obviously didn't consider Fate in this conversation. I'm very sorry.
I've had a lot of fun playing Savage Worlds.
But even that has some sort of... Like, when I think Savage Worlds, I'm kind of imagining a certain type of game already.
Yeah, and I think Savage Worlds really has a few settings that it's already kind of built to handle, and which it then goes, this is what we're running. I know when I played it, I was playing Actum Cthulhu, which, even though the base mechanics don't explicitly say, well, you're going to be doing, you know, two-fisted pulp in World War II, it is all kind of geared in that direction anyway. So
So I've been trying to slowly build a collection of what would be loosely called narrative war games. So I was lucky enough to get a secondhand copy of Inquisitor, formerly owned by Troika's Daniel Sell.
Ooh.
I know, it's like when people have like a car that was previously owned by a famous person, and I can tell people about that.
Yeah.
And in fact, my copies of Realm of Chaos, those two books bought by Zachary Cox and sent to me.
Nice.
So I only they'll take like secondhand copies from other game designers. But Rogue Trader is one that's evaded me.
Yeah, I've not been able to get hold of it. I've got the Realms of Chaos books and do not regret the amount of money I spent on them. But
no, they're amazing.
Like a lot of Games Workshop's design, an absolute pain to actually play, but just worth it as objects.
Definitely. I don't know how you would play it.
Mind boggles.
Yeah, so I was saying that, you know, I'm picking up these. I originally just picked them up because, you know, as a bit of a nostalgia trip, and then started to see the appeal of that sort of game, and that led into me, you know, working on a little system. But if it seems like Inquisitor is one that holds an especially dear place in your heart,
mm-hmm.
If somebody from a role playing game background sees Inquisitor in the charity shop for 15 quid. And they decide to pick it up. What do you think there is in there for somebody to take for their role-playing game?
So the thing which Inquisitor does is presents lots of very detailed, complex mechanics on the assumption that you're going to have a GM whose job it is to beat them into shape. And so you have the potential for one side to be just totally overpowered, or for you to foolishly decide to include grenades in your game, and suddenly there are all of these mechanical headaches appearing.
Yeah.
And the GM's job is to make all of that make sense, and to be able to go, look, we could do all of this math to work out where the grenade goes, but look, it's got a 30-yard radius, and is dealing 50 damage to everything in that radius, you're just dead. We don't need to roll that. And it's got that approach where it's much more taking the, we're all on the same side here. We're all here to have a good time. No, we're not trying to win. Winning is for, you know, 40k players. And if you take that approach to the game, where the rules don't really matter, winning doesn't really matter, being fair doesn't really matter. What matters is, frankly, you're spending some time with your friends doing cool stuff with some cool models and rolling some dice. If you can take that approach to gaming and apply it to basically anything, it will make your games better. Like in the playtests I'm doing at the moment, we've had a couple of situations where we're going, well, the rules don't really cover this, but fuck it, I reckon we can bodge something together with these mechanics and make something that works there. And that's an approach that I was first really introduced to via Inquisitor, long before I saw it in role-playing games.
And I think to some people that aren't used to that style of play, it sounds a little bit like saying, well, I'm not going to design a complete game here. You can fill in the blanks. And it sounds like lazy game design. But I think what it does is it, sooner or later, the GM is going to have to make those calls. Yeah. And sooner or later, you're going to have to, you know, make a decision. You're going to have to come to a compromise with the other person sat next to you.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're doing that early and often, then it just becomes less of a big deal when it happens.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. I think it's not to be underestimated that power of, I guess it's kind of rulings versus rules to get an old phrase, dig an old phrase out.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's awesome. And the other thing from Inquisitor, obviously the art is just
It's amazing. Stunning.
So I'd recommend if anyone does see it for £15 in a charity shop.
If you see it for 15 quid, get it and sell it on eBay, even if you don't want it for yourself. Like it goes for a lot.
Yeah. Oh, does it?
Yeah. Like it's one of the ones they didn't print many copies of, which has a cult following, so...
Oh. Well, no, I'm certainly not parting with my copy.
Oh, yeah. Like, I think the big thing is that you're being presented with these very strict, tightly defined paradigms of how the game works by the big companies. And you look at something like 5th Ed or 40K or whatever, and think, that's what the hobby is. And you can really make the game your own and break entirely out of those expectations. You just need to shift how you approach the game. And I think that's pretty universal to any analog gaming, really.
Absolutely. I'd argue any hobby at all.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so.
So, thank you, Emmy. Where can people find out more about your games and writing?
So I have a blog at cavegirlgames.blogspot.com, which is just kind of stuff, really. Like, a lot of it is dev notes for the stuff I'm working on. There'll be the odd play report. There's like two reviews up there and a bunch of homebrews I've made. And then I have a Twitter account where like a good 50% of my feed is angry queer stuff and angry British politics. And then the other 50% is gaming. So yeah, that's, I think, at Dying Stylishly, if you want me on Twitter. But, you know, it might not be your thing.
It's a good contrast to your blog.
Yeah, the blog is much more focused, whereas the Twitter feed is just whatever I happen to be thinking about at the moment.
Nice.
Which is frequently very stupid.
Brilliant. Well, thank you to everyone for listening, and thank you to everybody that supports this podcast on Patreon. As always, you can stay up to date at bastionland.com, and be sure to join me next week when I'll be exploring another niche in tabletop gaming. Bye for now.